stunned by desire, then shame. But before I can sort out these strange emotions, Whit grabs my arm and we're running, running, running again. Chapter 25. Janine, my brother huffs between breaths as we run near the icy gray harbor. What Jamila said. Lost. Can't let her down. He sprints ahead. Gotta find her. We're finally headed for the steam pipe to see if we can gather clues about what might have happened to Janine and the rest of the resistance kids, regardless of the risks. We've run through the now inactive war zone, where our old headquarters at Garfunkel's used to be, past the bombed-out holes and craters scarring the streets. We're nearly to the manhole that leads down to where we last saw our friends. But when I see the angry, frustrated look on Whit's face as he slows to a stop, my stomach knots up around my heart, and I can't help but imagine the worst. But the reality is even worse than that. Cold horror stops me in my tracks as I spot a crowd in the clearing, poking and jeering at two teenage girls tied to wooden posts. Stacks and stacks of kindling are piled at their feet. They're about to burn them alive. Please, we don't, the one with the longer hair pleads, sobs choking through her words. I swear, we're not even real witches. At this word, the crowd goes wild, surging forward with sneers and screams. The girl wails in desperation. The other girl is maybe 2 or 3 years younger, and her small face is unmoving, hopeless and dead, like she can't really fathom that this could be happening. My stomach twists and heaves. I can't believe it either. The two are sisters, by the look of it. Their dark almond eyes and thin noses mirror images of each other. With their whimsical, eclectic clothing, now torn, they stand out from the crisp red suits of their tormentors, which must have made them targets. Not again, my brother whispers at my side, tearing me back from the scene. You've seen something like this before? I say, anger and disbelief creeping into my voice. My accusation is clear. How could he not tell me about something so serious? I know, Whit says. His face is pained, apologetic. That's why I was so freaked back at the Niedermans, why we had to leave like that. Even with Pearl, he trails off, and I remember her flailing in the soldier's arms. I was scared, Whist. Really scared. I just wanted to save you from all that. Save me? My voice is rising. How is keeping me in the dark? I couldn't do anything last time anyway, Whit snaps. I was too late. He sighs heavily, his eyes on the ground. Never mind that, okay? These girls don't have much time. What are we going to do about it? He's right. We can't sit back and watch this. I look at the crowd. It really isn't that big, just totally nuts. We could take them easily. How about we show them a real witch burning? I suggest with a raised eyebrow. Whit nods grimly. I like your style, sister. And with that, I'm off and running, crazy like I haven't been in weeks or months, heading full speed at the unsuspecting crowd, windmilling my arms, shrieking bloody murder. Of course, flames are leaping from my head in a macabre halo of fury, too. At first, the mob comes together, undulating toward me and buzzing with possibility. But as I get closer, the people begin to scatter, the whites of their eyes bulging in terror, convinced that their day of reckoning has arrived and that this apparition will make them pay for their crimes. That's pretty much exactly what I was going for. Cowards at heart, every one of them. They want to burn every imaginative kid in sight. Anyone who is a little bit different and therefore vulnerable. A real witch is, of course, too much for them. As I lurch at the frenzied masses, my fire roaring, Whit rushes to the girls and works at untying their binds. In minutes, we have them freed and the square cleared of the murderous bigots. After it's over, the sisters cling to each other, mute and dazed from shock. They're shaking violently. Wit fingers their open gashes where the ropes cut into their flesh, healing them, but they flinch even at his touch. "It's okay, you're okay," I whisper, rubbing their shoulders. "It's over. We're here to help. Can you tell us your names?" "I'm Dana, and she's Lisa," the older girl says. "I don't know what happened. We were just walking. I had this hairpin. A woman yanked it out of my hair, and then they were all around us, pushing and shoving, scratching us with the pin, saying our blood was poison." I can see she's usually the chatty one, but right now her voice shakes, and it's clear she's trying not to totally lose it. "The thing is, we're not really even witches," she hiccups. "Not like you," she winces, fidgeting awkwardly. I mean... "It's okay," I smile. "I like being a witch. I just like to cook weird things, and Lisa plays the ukulele. I know it's illegal, but..." Tears spill onto her cheeks. "We never thought those things would get us killed." Lisa, the younger one, has doe eyes, huge and frightened beneath her fringe of heavy bangs, and they keep darting back to the ominous woodpile behind us. She squeezes Dana's hand, comforting her sister, but her body remains tensed as if ready to sprint. If only she knew where to run to, where it might be safe. "You guys can come with us," I offer. "We're trying to find our friends and get the resistance back together." I see Lisa's eyes jump longingly in her young face. She looks at Dana, the question hanging between them. But Dana shakes her head. "No," she sighs. "We really need to get home." I nod, the idea of home feeling sweet and sad. Home is long gone for us. The sisters shuffle off into the gray streets of our fallen city, arms wrapped around each other, shaking after their ordeal. I snap my fingers and watch as they transform into squirrels, scampering inconspicuously along the park's edge. It'll wear off within a couple of hours, but it should get them home without trouble, if they can avoid the poor scavengers in the alleys looking for a meal. "Safe travels," I whisper. Chapter 26. We start to head in the other direction down the road, but it looks like word of our little rescue has already gotten out. There's another, different group of people headed toward us, and I can tell even from here that they're official NO. Our middle-aged staff disguises have fallen away, and we're exposed. "Here we go," Wit says beside me. As they get closer, I see it's the young blonde soldier from the clinic. And he's not alone. He's got around 24 comrades with him this time, and they're all freaking giants. Not just big-boned, but like 7.5 feet tall, all decked out in way too tight NO t-shirts that emphasize their gigundo muscles. My eyes flick to the bank of the harbor. We could hop the fence, dive in, still have a chance at a getaway. It's maybe 10 running steps to the fence, and I'm faster than any of these big boys, guaranteed. Wit sees me looking at the water and shakes his head. He's reading my mind again, and now I'm reading his. He's saying, "We'll take what comes, Wistie." "Well, look what we have here," the blonde soldier says, his quiet voice velvety and menacing at once. He's still smiling that pearly, patronizing smile, his wolfish demeanor incredibly sinister. I suspect we might just find out why all those kids were so afraid. He can't be much older than I am, but he's already got that cold, calculating look of a man driven by greed. "So this is the famous Wisteria and Whitford Allgood, the deadly witch and wizard," the soldier says with mock enthusiasm. "We hear that you've ruined a perfectly good barbecue. It is my great honor to meet you, despite all the messes you've been making. His eyes sparkle as if we're all in on the joke. Talking is always my first form of defense, and my motor mouth starts right up before I even know what I'm saying to Blondie. I'm sorry we can't say the same about you and your extra-large playmates, I blurt. It doesn't come out as confident-sounding as I'd hoped, because the truth is, I'm seriously creeped out by this guy. There's just something about him that seems psychopathic, unpredictable. Like, he could kiss you or cut off your limbs and he'd probably feel the same level of excitement. The soldier laughs and it makes me shiver. They said you were funny. Isn't she funny, guys? The giants move in around us, roughly wrenching our arms behind our backs. And such lovely red hair, like flame, the leader says, stepping toward me. He strokes strands around my face, and I flinch. My cheeks heat up in a mix of embarrassment and vanity. I can feel Wit tense beside me. Regardless, the one who is the one will be most pleased that you're on your way to see him, the creep continues. In fact, I'm happy to personally deliver you. No extra charge for the service. You have my word on it. He smiles again. I think you're going to have to break your promise on this one, Wit says tightly. My sister and I aren't going anywhere with you, buddy. Pierce, the soldier says, extending a pale, well-manicured hand. My name is Pierce.
Chapter 27. Pierce chuckles, withdrawing his hand. So sorry. I see you're otherwise occupied. I try to twist away from this jerk's beefy sidekicks, who are still holding us back. I'm already wound pretty tight, and another obstacle isn't helping. The narrow strip of asphalt where we're standing along the water is about the only area that hasn't been demolished around the old resistance stronghold, and it's impossible to look at the craters in the wounded earth and not think of our friends. If they're alive, and that's a big if, they're definitely running out of time. And now, we have to deal with this egomaniacal kid. At ease, boys, he says, and they instantly free our arms. Pierce looks like a child next to these 7-foot goons, but they're clearly afraid of him. I get the feeling he shouldn't be underestimated. So this is the famous healer, the incomparable athlete, the sensitive poet. Pierce steps forward and peers into my face, as if he's studying an intensely interesting scientific specimen. How does he know all of this about me? We might be in it deeper than I thought. I stand up straighter, my bulk and height an implied threat. If Pierce thinks I'm going to shrink away from him, he can think again. And it's a shame we don't have time for you to give us a bit of a show, Wisteria, he muses, turning to my sister. The way he says it, suggesting things that are much more uncomfortable for an older brother to imagine than just a fire show, makes my hands ball into fists. I take a step in front of Wisty, and Pierce smirks at me. Dyna competence are so very rare these days, he says mildly. And so tricky to catch, one of the giants mutters from behind him. Pierce's head whips around to glare at the loudmouth. Touchy subject, apparently. Did we not discuss this beforehand, Fafnir? He asks the giant, venom dripping from his words. This is obviously a guy who was used to having things done his way. That you were to be silent while I was interacting with the all-goods? The underling ducks his head and says meekly, Yes, sir. A circle widens around him as his buddies move off, condemning the offender. Come here, Pierce says, almost inaudibly. Fafnir is shaking now, cowering, and Wisty looks at me, sidelong, unsure of what to expect. But I didn't mean... I said come here, Pierce explodes. He wraps his black cloak tightly around him as the wind coming off the water ripples his fair hair, and for the first time I notice the goosebumps on my own arms. Reluctantly, Fafnir slinks toward Pierce like a dog with its tail between its legs. When the man's close enough, Pierce reaches up and touches the giant's head, as if he's blessing him or something. And then the most insane thing happens. The skin on the giant's face seems to just fall away. All that's left is a naked skull sitting atop this huge body, and when Pierce lets go, the body crumples to the ground. Its skull rolls to a stop in front of us. As Wistie and I stand there with our eyes bugging out of our heads and our mouths hanging open in disbelief, a few of the other big boys drag the body toward the bank, and Pierce wipes his hand nonchalantly on a handkerchief. "Where were we?" he says, turning back to us and smiling brightly as if nothing's happened. "Ah, yes. You are about to accompany me to visit the One." I am scared. I'm horrified. I am super freaked out at this guy's total lack of self-restraint and a little in awe of his power. But I'm furious, too. Livid. This is not the world we were promised as children, and no one is ever going to make this man pay if I don't right now. "What, you can't handle us yourself?" I taunt. I know the way egos work. You just have to push the right buttons. "You're probably nothing without that pathetic little trick of yours. I bet I could take you. Mano a mano." I normally don't sink to this base level, I swear, but I'm just about at the end of my rope, and there's no way I'm letting them take me in without a fight. Today, I let Celia slip through my fingers again. Today, I watched a good friend die. Today, I found out Janine, calm, compassionate, serious-eyed Janine, whom I care about more than I want to admit, is probably dead. I'm ready to pound someone into the ground, and if anyone ever deserved it, it's Pierce. "Oh, come now, Whitford. Must we always resort to violence?" Pierce ironically raises a conspiratorial eyebrow at me, as if reading my thoughts. I flex my fingers in response, and then he starts to laugh, deep, rolling peals of laughter that are incredibly unsettling coming out of that stern, cruel face. The rest of us stand around awkwardly, not really sure what's so hilarious, but Pierce just keeps right on cackling. The guy is seriously unhinged. "Mano a mano," he snorts. "How about mojo a mojo?" And then out of that wide, gaping mouth of his bursts a powerful gust of wind. Next thing I know, I'm on the ground, coughing, confused and breathless, my feet knocked clear out from under me. He blew me right over, like I was a blade of grass. As I'm trying to get my breath back, Pierce's face becomes serious. "Your M doesn't work so well in the city anymore, does it, golden boy?" he purrs. "Unfortunately for you, mine does."
Chapter 28. "Wit!" I yell, struggling against the three big goons who've now got my arms wrenched behind my back. My brother holds up a hand, telling me to chill, like he's got this whole nightmarish scene under control. But he's on his knees, already down. Blood from his nose is making awful bright patterns on the asphalt. Wit can't expect me to just stand here and watch as Pierce does his face-melting trick on him too, can he? After I've already watched my parents die, and my friend Margot, and countless innocent kids, now I'm just supposed to do nothing as my brother takes on this complete sociopath? Pierce smirks at me with the look of a person who enjoys torturing small animals, and something in me snaps. Now that the glamour has worn off, my M is coming back. My fingers start to tingle, my face gets hot, my temper boils over. And then, I just explode. The guys holding me drop my arms, wincing as if they've been singed. And suddenly, there are 3-foot flames reaching out from my body, white hot and roaring. I start to move toward Pierce, my wall of fire reaching for him, but he doesn't budge. He doesn't even look frightened. Unfortunately, before I can scorch anyone in a blaze of glory, I'm tackled by at least 10 of the 7-footers, who proceed to stop, drop, and roll all over me. So much for the New Order freak roast.
Chapter 29. Bravo! Bravo! Pierce claps slowly in mock appreciation. He's licking his lips and circling Wistie closely, that predatory smile playing across his face. I must say, Wisteria, he taunts, his lips nearly brushing her ear, if I didn't hate you so much, I might be in love. Wistie scowls, and I lurch at him. I'm immediately restrained by the giants. If you even touch her, I'll... Pierce's icy eyes twinkle with amusement. You'll what? Write a poem about it? Absolutely. It'll be called Ode to a Smashed Face, I quip, lamely, trying to hide my alarm. Ah, yes. Mono a mano, Pierce says mockingly, making air quotes with his hands, then pauses. What do you say, Whitford? Still up for a little fight to the death? I stall. A breeze wafts in the smell of the seawater behind us, but I can think only of the giant skull grinning up from the bottom of the harbor, and it makes me queasy. Wistie shoots me a look of alarm and disapproval. This is so not what we're into. But I feel backed into a corner here, and though I'm ashamed to admit it, there's a tiny, dark, sick part of me that wonders if I could actually do it. I nod at Pierce uneasily. Wit! Wistie protests, and I try to convey, what else am I supposed to do, with my eyes? I glance around at the eerie setting, the demolished buildings, the abandoned path, the waves crashing against the shore again and again, like they have for millions of years. Apart from homeless plague sufferers squatting in the doorways of half-fallen buildings, there's no one around, no one else to bear witness, no one to hear me beg for mercy. Maybe I can just knock him unconscious long enough to get out of here. Brilliant. Renzi? Pierce looks behind him. The biggest goon of the bunch steps forward and nods, cracking his knuckles, and I swallow hard. He can't mean... Wait, are you serious? I meant you against me, Pierce. What kind of coward has a guy twice his size fight in his place? Oh, this isn't about courage at all, Wit. It's much bigger than that. I'm interested in seeing what you can do. A test, if you will. As in, to see if you can not die. Chapter 30. The giant and I circle each other, my mind racing to come up with a not-die plan. The truth is, the odds aren't exactly in my favor. I'm a pretty solid guy, and I've gone toe-to-toe with many a gargantuan thug during football, often called fool ball, the way we played it, since it was such an insane version of the sport. But Renzi is built like a bulldozer, with his veins popping out of his thick arms like ropes. Even when he crouches down, I barely come up to his chest. Renzi has a glint in his eye, and he looks around at his bros, who all start laughing, and a knot forms in the pit of my stomach. It's quickly replaced by a sucker punch from the giant that leaves me gagging and doubled over. Then a knee explodes into my chin, a club-like fist spins me around like a top, and a metallic taste fills my mouth. Through double vision, I can just barely make out my sister's anguished face. Pierce looks disappointed on the sidelines, as if he's about to lose a bet. Then something happens that I can't quite explain. Something clicks, and a knowledge, an understanding, a power is unleashed within me. I slide forward, as if following some secret choreography, jab my left fist like a thunderbolt to connect with Renzi's chin, cross for a body sack with my right hand, then spin out of the giant's reach. Jab, cross, left hook, pivot, low jab, spin, wham! My body moves without my direction, anticipating the man's every move, and applying advanced hand-to-hand combat techniques I'm sure I know nothing about. As my fists connect with his jaw, then his temple, then his kidney, it's like I'm standing outside myself. I feel furious. I feel powerful. I feel invincible. I feel out of control. My arms are incredible deadly weapons of steel that Renzi doesn't have a fighting chance to fend off. His face is practically roadkill, and his left arm is hanging at a weird angle from his body, but I can't stop. As my board-like hand connects with the giant's kneecap, I'm relieved as Renzi finally goes down like a rock, his face distorting into a mask of pain. He's not dead, but it's over. I look down at my fists, unable to comprehend what just happened. Pierce steps into the circle. Loser, he scowls, putting his hand on Renzi's mammoth square head. And the giant crumples, the two empty eye sockets of his skull gaping up at us. My stomach churns. I am never going to get used to that. Well done, wizard, Pierce says, the jovial tone returning to his voice. I tense, understanding the underlying threat. That was certainly an entertaining little act you put on for us. Unfortunately for you, your sister is the only all-good the one really needs. Since she is the one with the gift, you are, what's the word, expendable. Pierce bounds, cat-like, and before I can direct my newfound defenses his way, his deadly hands are gripping the sides of my head, searing into my temples. The world burns bright, then shatters. Life rearranges itself into just two words, flashing in bold, blinking letters across my consciousness. Stop and pain. It's excruciating. My eyes roll back but snap open to punctuate each new bolt of agony pulsing through my body. I see one of Pierce's icy blue eyes squinting, the top of a tree, its bare branches clawing at the dismal sky. Wisty's slender fingers across her mouth, holding back a scream. A white, hot, blinding light. My brain is a fried egg that can't seem to process anything. A short-circuiting mass of nerves screaming for this experience to end. But it goes on, and on, and on. Why isn't it over yet? My vision comes into focus again, just long enough for me to see the shocked look on Pierce's face, and then his features harden with determination again. He leans forward and squeezes my skull even harder. My jaw is clenched tight enough to grind steel. I grasp at his fingers, frantically trying to rip them free, and I feel my legs buckle, my knees smashing into the hard ground. I wonder vaguely if other bodily functions have given way as well, but it's a fleeting thought as my entire being is immersed in another explosion of anguish. I have a hazy understanding that that awful sound, that shrieking, that brutal, animalistic howl echoing off the buildings and drowning out the waves from the harbor, must be coming from me. How am I still alive? With this realization, this glimmer of hope, I focus through the physical pain, somehow numb my senses, and concentrate every effort on shutting out the energy flowing into me, pushing away the blinding light, healing. But still the pain throbs, and I'm done for. I can feel it, the life leaking out of me, my system shutting down when, abruptly it stops. The pain, the dying, all of it. Pierce screams, clutching his head as I had only moments before, and staggers backward, collapsing onto the ground in a dead faint. At that instant, nausea overtakes me, and I spend a moment retching on the ground, black spots dancing in front of my eyes. When I can see straight again, I wipe off my mouth and sit up, trying to focus on my surroundings. The giants are edging away from me with baffled, horrified looks on their faces, and my sister's mouth hangs open. Her expression a mixture of shock, concern, and victory. Tears are streaming down her face. I'm nursing the worst migraine in the history of headaches, but I've still got enough brain matter left to understand this simple fact. For maybe the first time ever, Pierce's skull trick didn't work. What does that mean, I wonder, right before I black out.
Chapter 31. Wit, are you alive? Wit! I'm shaking my brother's shoulders violently, trying not to get hysterical while I'm alone with a dozen bewildered giants and two passed out wizards. Wit's fine, I tell myself. He looked okay, or relatively okay, right before his eyes rolled up into his head. Wake up, wake up, wake up, I urge silently. Wake up before Pierce does. I eye the handsome psychopath sprawled on the gravel. His hard features look softer, almost gentle, in his unconscious state. Whether as a result of my telepathic begging or not, my totally ridiculous, irresponsible, admittedly awesome older brother finally stirs, his eyes fluttering open. I don't know whether to hug him or smack him, but he's not registering my shock, awe, relief anyway. He's preoccupied with something else. Is that? He squints, looking past me. I turn to see Mrs. Highsmith, our parents' longtime friend, standing just behind me, looking grand in an extravagant hat and an impeccable blood-red silk suit. The last time I saw her, she was pressed up against her ceiling, being tortured by the one until her eyes bulged out of her head. Yet somehow I'm not surprised to see her now. She's that kind of lady. You silly children! Out here without proper coats! She scolds, seemingly unaware that Whit's covered in blood. There's an unconscious guy on the ground next to him, and we're surrounded by confused, brawny bouncers. Is the dotty old witch persona an act? I have no idea. She likes to keep us guessing. What would your mother think? And I'm supposed to be looking after you! She hasn't exactly consistently lived up to that task so far in our sad tale, but I have to admit, she's gotten us out of a couple of jams with some surprisingly powerful M, and I'd bet she's got another few tricks up her designer sleeve. You know those teachers you think are totally kooky and weird, but whom you actually learn the most from in the end? Well, I'm hoping that's how this turns out. Mrs. H glances over at Pierce, who seems to be regaining consciousness. Tsk, tsk, she clucks. I knew that one was a bad apple from the start. What a temper. I expect he'll be a bit crabby when he wakes up, She squeezes our hands, turns abruptly, and commands, Better run! We stumble after her, but even in heels, the old witch is way faster than we are. Chapter 32. Moments later, we're sitting in Mrs. Highsmith's new kitchen in her new apartment, since her last apartment basically had a tornado hit it. A tornado courtesy of the one who is the one. Where exactly is her new place, you ask? I'm not quite sure, but from a glance out the window, I'd say if she's trying to blend in with the New Order drones, she's doing a good job. How did we get here? I can't exactly tell you that either. All I know is that Mrs. H took off ahead of us. The world seemed to cave in on itself. The laws of physics reconfigured. I felt totally motion sick. And the next thing I knew, I was sitting on a bar stool and Mrs. H was asking me to pass the witch hazel. I feel like I've been playing with a light socket, and Whit's fuse looks seriously blown. But when I glance up at Mrs. H, not a hair is out of place on her gray head. Her suit remains perfectly pressed, and she's still clicking around in those impossibly high heels. Typical. Mrs. H is stirring a brew of the foulest smelling business you can possibly imagine. Like a marriage of sulfur and sewage that is going to produce some truly rank offspring. I back away from the stinky slop and join Whit in taking in the surroundings. Her new apartment isn't homey and welcoming like her last place was. I guess to live among the NO elite, you sacrifice space and personality. She's got a red-clad doorman and a depressing but striking view of the Capitol building from her 15th floor window. She has kept some of the key things from her last place, though, and they don't exactly add to the feeling of roominess. The walls are crowded with banned art, and sculptures lean in doorways. Just like I remembered. There are pathways carved out through the litter, but so many musical instruments cover the floor anyway that someone's going to break an ankle. The woman has some real hoarding issues. And books. Stacks and stacks of books everywhere. Jockeying for space on bureau tops, tipping over on coffee tables, piled in swaying mountains on the floor. Even if I didn't get straight A's, I always loved to read. And now that just about every single book has been banned, the pull is even stronger. I feel almost tender toward these tomes. The one has taken away our power to learn, grow, imagine, and escape through words. Why didn't we fight harder to keep it before it was torn away? I pick up one book gingerly and brush off its dusty cover. The cemetery book, Mrs. H. says over my shoulder. Terrific choice! Plenty of great wisdom in that one. Yeah, like what? I laugh. How to avoid dying? Because that's some advice I could actually use. Well, yes, and that you shouldn't fear the dead, she says, looking at my brother eerily. The dead, like all of us, have limitations. She says it in that weird voice she uses to convey greater knowledge. I roll my eyes. Mom would probably smack me, since she said Mrs. Highsmith was here to help us, and anyone who can duke it out with the one who is the one and hold her own, or at least not get killed on the spot, is one tough witch. Still, can I just say how sick I am of adults doing the wink and nod charade? Like, not until you're older. I mean, we're supposed to be the children of the prophecy who change everything. Any advanced knowledge would be pretty freaking helpful right about now. She turns to me. And Wisteria, you would do well to remember that wits, courage, and compassion are the keys to survival. Her eyes sweep the room, sparkling. And music. I nod. Now that I can relate to. On Mrs. H's command, rock music pours into the apartment, and she starts to shake and sway, the beat taking over her muscles. She stirs the pot as she moves, the gruel sloshing over the sides. I remember every song I've ever heard, every note, Mrs. H shouts over the music. Then she frowns. Well, almost every song. Of course, there are notable exceptions. Anything by the Cumin Girls I sort of choose to forget, for instance. When a familiar old ballad blasts through the room, I join in. Oh yeah, I shriek. Turn it up! I look around, but I can't seem to locate where the music is coming from. Mrs. H shoots us a shy smile and taps her ears, and the volume increases. Never forget, lovelies, the music comes from within. I shake my head at the old adage, but I have to smile. She's a fruity old witch, that's for sure. But she's right. She's always been right. Suddenly, I'm filled with the same feeling I had just once before, when performing on stage in front of thousands of Resistance supporters at the Stockwood Music Festival, amped by a wall of speakers created with my own magic. I shiver. One day I'll get back there. Maybe Mrs. Highsmith and I have more in common than I thought. My brother takes her hand and whips her around the kitchen like they're at some kind of ball. After a minute, she turns to stir the soup, and Whit grabs my arm, laughing. We spin round and round the familiar tune, and when we finish in a dip, laughing, Whit's eyes are shining. That was Dad's favorite song, he says, breathless. Yeah, I sigh, eyeing one of Mrs. H's guitars longingly. I really wish that he'd live to see me rock the socks off the new order. Had lived? Mrs. Highsmith raises an eyebrow. Oh, children, you didn't really believe they were dead, did you? Tears well in my eyes instantaneously. The hoods, the crowd, the smoke, the awful smoke. What do you mean? I demand. Are you claiming they're alive? Well, they're alive for now, the old witch says. Barely alive. Alive as in struggling to breathe air in and out, as yet unextinguished, if you will. Wisty, don't believe her, Whit says, jaw set. I saw it with my own eyes. I watched them get executed. Mrs. Highsmith laughs her musical laugh, and it looks like Whit might actually strangle her. But darlings, she says lightly, gesturing toward the shiny surface of the cooking pot, see for yourselves. My brother hangs back, unbelieving, but I'm unable to stop myself from bolting forward. At first, I can't see through the salty tears, but I rub at my eyes, and there, on the lid, are two bent figures with sunken eyes and hollow cheeks, standing near water. Mom and Dad! Alive!
Chapter 33. A little cry escapes Wisty's mouth, and I rush forward to join my sister. My parents seem to be standing near a river, waiting with a lot of other people. They are emaciated and as pale as paper. Mom! I shout. Dad! Their faces waver like an image caught in steam. Wisty looks at me, her eyes pleading. What are they doing there? Those don't look like New Order soldiers. Dad, where's the river? Tell us where you are. He doesn't answer, so I turn to Mrs. H. Is it in the capital? Do you know how to get there? How do we find you? Wisty asks, her hands gripping the sides of the lid. Mrs. Highsmith's kind eyes look at Wisty, then at me. The river is in the Shadowland, of course, she says gently. Where else would it be, lambs? That's where the river has always been, where people cross over to the other side. I grab Wisty's arm, ignoring Mrs. H's ethereal BS for the moment. We can get there. We just have to find a portal to the Shadowland, and we can bring them back. I don't care about the risks. I don't even... Wist? She isn't listening to me, and I follow her eyes back to the image of our parents and see why. Mom's eyes are looking right into hers, and she's shaking her head in terror. Stay away, her lips mouth at us in her gaunt face. Promise not to come here, she wails. You must not come. Dad steps behind her and puts one hand in the air like a stop sign. He looks about 100 years old, and the gesture seems to zap the last of his energy, but his eyes are fierce as they lock with mine. I forbid it, he says. And suddenly I feel tiny, like I'm 4 years old again and asking to ride our neighbor's bike. Dad's eyes blaze inside his gray face, and just when I'm about to cry out to him, my parents disappear. No! I shout. Wait! But the image has vanished completely, and the lid reflects my own horrified face in its place. Wisty's voice comes out in a whisper. They're alive. And they want us to just do nothing? I can see she's close to losing it. Mrs. Highsmith, I turn to the old witch, suddenly angry at her for not giving us the guidance she'd promised. You think I care what they said about staying away? We're obviously going there. Will you help us find the portal, or are we on our own? Mrs. H looks like she's got a million other secrets she'll never reveal. There will come a time in your lives, Whitford and Wisteria, when you have to make your own decisions, when you have to go your own way, when you have to disobey the injunctions of your parents. She peers into our faces, eyes bright. I'm thrilled you understand that that time is now.
Chapter 34. Now eat up, children. I've a plan. Mrs. H puts two steaming bowls of the gruel in front of us. It looks and smells like cat food, but whatever. Wit eats a spoonful and then pushes the rest of the bowl away while trying not to make a puke face. I think I'll pass on mine. We're not here for the food anyway. Listen very closely, dears. If not followed explicitly, this plan could easily result in your deaths.
Well, at least she's being straight with us.
Whitford, I understand that you have experience in the depths of the Shadowland. Wit nods, and Mrs. H's eyes bore into him. Look ahead. Your vision will serve you well, young man, as you journey to this foul place of writhing, hungry spirits. The labyrinth will deceive you, but you must navigate the depths of the soul to find your parents. Follow the animals to the river, and love will meet you there.
Whatever that means.
Wit looks like he doesn't totally speak Mrs. H's language of soul riddles, but he nods solemnly anyway. I, on the other hand, am already getting annoyed. Our parents are out there in some Shadowland abyss,
And I'm sorry, but I don't have time to learn about the meaning of life before we find them. Still, when Mrs. H turns to me, I find I'm holding my breath. And you, Wisteria, have the greatest task of all. I'm afraid your trip will be arduous, your task mammoth, and the odds overwhelmingly stacked against you. She pauses meaningfully, and I lean forward. Anything, I say. I'll do it. Now that I know they're alive, every fiber of my being aches to see Mom and Dad. Mrs. H beams at me. It is you, and you alone, who must deal with the one who is the one. Now. Wait, what? My spoon clatters to the floor. The one, as in the all-powerful one who's been trying to track us down and skewer us for months? You're not serious. I stare at her in horror, my jaw hanging open like a guppy's. Mrs. H nods expectantly. Our parents are on the verge of death here, I protest, incredulous. And while Wit gets to go traipsing after them in the Shadowland, which I have experience in too, by the way, I'm supposed to just, what, knock on the door of the most powerful being in the overworld and then deal with him? I'm shouting now. Mrs. Highsmith looks me over with quiet disapproval, and then she says something totally whack job. Tell me, Wisteria, do you remember anything, anything at all, from your biology 101 class? How about physics? Chemistry? No? I should have expected as much from a truant. I shudder involuntarily at the familiar words. It's practically the exact same thing the one said to me back at his pad, forever and a day ago, when I was supposed to be proving myself as a witch. Mrs. Highsmith cocks an eyebrow, and I'm speechless. Just what exactly is going on here? I glare at her. Look, if you want to focus on the past, fine. In the past, we've seen the one control water and air and the earth. We've watched him empty oceans, whip up tornadoes, and split open the ground with a flick of his pinky finger. How is anyone supposed to fight that? Mrs. H nods and holds my face in her hands, and I feel like I'm about 5 years old. But what he doesn't have is your fire, Wisty, your energy, your electricity. He may control the earth, but he doesn't control the people on it. At least not in their thoughts. Not yet. But if what the one believes is true, if your powers extend to the electrical impulses of the brain, he'll use you to control not only the government of the overworld, but the actual minds of all humanity in every dimension. I frown, uncertain what to make of this. Wit's kneading his knuckles into his forehead, deep in thought. Don't you understand the implications of your power, darling? If the one who is the one succeeds, it will be the end of the last shred of free will any of us has left. It will be the end of resistance, of creativity, even hope. It will be the end of everything. Okay, I sigh, feeling like a very heavy chain has just been placed around my neck. But what am I actually supposed to do to beat the one? My so-called gift feels like this thing that's so much bigger than me, something I can't even totally control, and I'm not even sure what it's for. Mrs. H considers her answer. The gift is certainly not to be used to be God, only to prevent others from trying to be God. I nod, waiting for a directive, but Mrs. H shakes her head. I can't tell you exactly how to use these tremendous gifts you've been given, she says gravely. To grow and to understand the prophecy, you must learn to master them on your own. I sigh, the gravity of the situation settling in my gut. I'm supposed to infiltrate a heavily guarded compound and pick a fight with the most powerful being the world has ever seen, and Wit is supposed to go stumbling through the Shadowland, where people either get eaten by the voracious lost ones or get so lost in the haze that their minds turn to gruel. All because of a prophecy someone saw written on a wall. Because, for some reason, they all believe in us. A truant and a football star. I look at Whit, the one person I can always count on, who has been with me through every terrible loss, every struggle, every victory. Are we really going to do this? Whit nods, his eyes bright with hope, and I squeeze his hand, suppressing a feeling of panic. Of course we are. Besides our lives, what else have we got to lose?
Book 2, A Feast of Souls. Chapter 35. The Shadowland is a labyrinth of despair. It's a knot of wrong turns, a blanket of fog weakening your resolve, a stench of lost souls who'll do anything to claw their way out of this purgatory. The Shadowland is the taste of fear in your mouth urging you forward, deeper into the maze, farther from any connection to time, sanity, or the living. But the Shadowland is also Celia, the girl I loved and lost, a beautiful soul known in this purgatory as a half-light, whose life was taken too early, who I'd do anything to get back. And now it's my parents, waiting for me by a river in the depths of its secrets. So with a cocktail of emotions coursing through me, I'm finally on my way there. But first I have to get to the portal, the only one Mrs. H is sure is still in operation. It's deep in an area of the capital I've never been through before. I walk briskly, and soon the elegant white stone buildings give way to a concrete no man's land, full of heavily guarded factories belching thick, white steam into the still air. I turn down a narrow alleyway, and shadows shift as men bundled in rags move away from me in the dark. I stand straighter, trying to make the most of my big frame. I walk beside the concrete wall, barbed wire snarling along the top, 12 feet up. A red sign tacked to it reads, "Testing Facility, Keep Out." Two exhausted-looking soldiers are keeping watch, but one appears more concerned with rolling a cigarette. The security measures almost seem ridiculous anyway. The rumors of what goes on in the One's experimental labs are more than enough to keep out the curious. Except vengeful wizards, I guess. Though these guys seem like slackers, I see the brass NOPE pin of honor on the soldiers' uniforms, meaning that they're actually commandos in the New Order Portal Elite Squad, the existence of which the NO vehemently denies, of course. They're curves, drafted to enter the underworld and report back, since the One is officially a straight and narrow who can't travel between the worlds himself. Trained wolves snarl at the NOPE soldiers' feet, teeth bared and ready to snap. I picture my parents' wan faces, Dad's forbidding hand, and the fear in Mom's eyes. Something was going on there at the river, something they didn't want me to see. But nothing, not Dad, not the One, not even a pack of wolves, is going to keep me from the Shadowland. It's the last place in the universe any sane person would want to be, but that terrifying land of stolen memory and shortened lives holds Celia, my parents, and everything I've lost. For better or worse, the Shadowland holds my destiny. Chapter 36. When you're backed into a corner, sometimes the only thing to do is the stupidest thing you can think of. To that effect, without so much as a disguise to help me out, I march up to the New Order thugs slouching against the dirty concrete. Confidence is key, Dad always used to say. You can do almost anything if you believe you can. And actually, it kind of works for a second. I don't betray any motive, and it's as if the guards have forgotten that they're supposed to be guarding the place. They just look at me with bored expressions. For a minute, I think I'm actually going to get away with strolling right past them, but unfortunately, the wolves are a bit more on the ball. The death dogs snarl and start to tug at their chains, mouths foaming at me in hunger and hatred. This perks the soldiers right up, and they scramble to get their weapons pointed at me. The youngest one tries to be authoritative. "No one goes in or out, bub," he says, his gun leveled between my eyes. "Entry is strictly forbidden." "I've been sent by the One who is the One," I hear my voice telling them calmly, before I know what I'm saying. The older, bald one looks at me uncertainly and mutters something to his comrade. and I try not to let my hands shake in front of the hellbeasts, who probably have built-in lie detectors or something. I have an official letter, I continue boldly. One of the guards nods and holds out a hand expectantly. Great. I do not, in fact, have an official letter. All I have is a crumpled-up slip of paper with Mrs. Highsmith's direction to the portal on it, but I pull the pathetic thing out of my pocket anyway and thrust it at him. The older one takes the proffered letter and unfolds it, then barks, What's this? It's just a piece of paper with street names. Arrest! Before the guy can get the rest of the words out, I'm off. This is what I've trained for. This is what I was made for. Saving my parents. My feet fly beneath me, faster than I've ever run before, carrying me straight at that heavy wooden door guarding the portal. And as I hear the wolves snapping at my heels, as I sense the guards taking aim with their fingers quivering on the triggers, I hope, I pray that I'm still a curve, that my body will bend into the other dimension, that I'll melt through this solid door into the Shadowland and into the arms of Celia and my parents, and everyone who is counting on me to be a hero this last time. I'm praying that I don't just smash into that oak and get arrested. Because after all I've been through, after all Mom and Dad have been through, that would seriously suck. I'm flying, leaping, flailing forward with one final heave, holding my breath. And the last thing I feel is a tremendous crack, as if my head's exploding. Chapter 37. Well, that was intense. With portals, each one is a different experience, but it's never very much fun. There have been times it wasn't unlike going through a car wash, times it felt like being squeezed out a birth canal, in Wistia's words, and one notable episode when I was sure I looked like a tomato smashed against a wall when I came out the other side. But this one was unlike anything I'd ever gone through. After that initial nasty bump on the head, I thought it was all over, but then I felt the weirdest sensation, like my cells were rearranging themselves or something. I'm definitely in the Shadowland now, because I can hardly see a thing. Celia! I call out tentatively. Mom? Dad? As I stumble through an opaque wall of fog, I gag on the smell of rotting sewage. No, rotting flesh. And my heart flutters with recognition. Lost ones. Less than angelic humans stuck in the labyrinth of the Shadowland so long their very souls have rotted into a mass of stink and decay. Monsters tormented by loss and demented with hunger. Hunger for human flesh. God, no. I hear the screams of men being tortured, devoured. Soldiers? The NOPE guards leaping after me into the portal and into the cannibalistic maws of lost ones? I shudder violently, but though the shrieks go silent, there's nowhere to run. Suddenly, dozens of decaying arms grab at me from out of the smoke, their slimy flesh slipping around my shoulders, my chest, my throat. I scream, but the sound is muffled among the moaning and frenzy. I push back at them, wrenching my body in utter terror. Don't try to fight us, idiot! A low, garbled female voice coos into my ear, full of ill intent. You can't win. Don't you see? We're already dead. The others cackle, and the lost girl continues. Don't you wish you were dead? She puts a clammy hand on my cheek, and I recoil. I'm glad that I can't see her rotting face through the haze. You will be. She laughs, and my stomach turns as I now begin to make out a hint of stringy flesh left on her face as it shakes terribly, her cavernous eyes dancing in front of me. Soon, very, very soon, you'll be dead too, handsome idiot stranger.
Chapter 38. My face is scrubbed clean, my hair is brushed, glossy, and trailing down my back like a flame, and I'm decked out in a chic green dress that Mrs. Highsmith had lying around. I click along the spotless streets in my two tight shoes as if I don't even care that the security cameras from the surrounding mansions, each of which I'm sure comes equipped with a vicious wolf mutt growling just beyond the gate, are trained on my every move. If it weren't for the glint in my eye, you'd swear I was New Order youth all the way. After weeks on the run covered in blood, grime, and who knows what else, I almost feel like I'm going to a fancy NO recital. My old frenemy Byron Swain once told me about those so-called parties that culminate in an elaborate recitation of the one's successes, with the NO elite dressed to the nines and patting one another on the back. As excruciating as that would be, I wish I were going there instead of where I'm actually headed. My showdown with the one. Maybe to save the fate of the world, but more likely to die. I'm muttering Mrs. Highsmith's advice. Wits, courage, compassion. Like a mantra. And I'm so worked up, I almost walk right in the path of a youth troop on patrol. There are two straight lines of stone-faced children, marching stiffly and